As we were talking recently about what kind of topic to talk about this morning, it seemed very natural in a series in which we're talking about some of the potentials for the Christian life and its depth and its texture, that somewhere early on in the fall series it made sense to talk about the topic that we have in front of us today. I just want to say as we begin, I feel very keenly aware this morning of what is probably a very diverse set of states of heart and mind here, and I hope that wherever you find yourself in that wide diversity of possibilities, that we might have something good for you. We're talking, of course, about adoption, and adoption is really a metaphor. And so I want to just think for a minute with you what that means when you say something is a metaphor. I think you all know the word. Most of you probably know a definition. A metaphor is where you take something that is familiar and you use something of the qualities of that item to capture the qualities of something else. All right? So a metaphor allows for a comparison of things. A metaphor, by the way, metaphors in life were just part of the verbal scenery that we are every day a part of. If you even today just stop to think through the day where you talk to people, how often you use something as a picture for something else, I think you might actually be quite surprised. I thought of just a couple, just to give you a taste of it. If we say, that song was a sweet song, you've taken a quality from something, sweetness, and applied it in a way it normally doesn't apply. It's a metaphor, you know. My car is a lemon. We just had a car fail on us yesterday. It died an honorable death. It was not a lemon, but it is gone. But if you say a car is a lemon, it's a bitter experience with it, you know, sorry that it's gone kind of thing. George Washington was the father of our country. We all know what father is, and we're using that metaphorically. I can't resist, to those of you who are sort of the Star Wars type, metaphors be with you. Couldn't resist. Oh, come on. Could you do better? Could you do better this morning? Hey, we're working on it. I was also thinking, sometimes you have bad metaphors, you know, metaphors that just don't work. I have a list of bad metaphors. These were real items used in some high school papers. Included things like, he was as tall as a 6'3" tree. Or her eyes were like two brown circles with big black dots in the center. Or, my favorite, the little boat drifted across the pond exactly the way a bowling ball wouldn't. So they can misfire. They don't work. But hopefully we get some that do. Anyway, I was struck, and I hope you'll be impressed by how many probably very, very familiar things that somewhere in the Bible are getting at how do people relate to God are actually metaphors of some kind. Just brief, we're going to zero in on one, but just to give you a sense of the richness of what's out there, and there's plenty. When it says in Exodus 4:22, and God says in Exodus 4:22, Israel, as a whole group of people, Israel is my son. And that's a very precious kind of a statement to make, because you know, if your parents think of their children, hopefully in a very, very gentle and personal way, Israel is my son, says God. Or how about the familiarity we have with all the sacrifices that go on in the Old Testament? You know, a sacrifice, kill an animal, doesn't deal with your sin in any objective or effective kind of way. It's a metaphor. It points you to something, the blood, the death, and so forth. Or how about the place of worshiping God? In a number of places, such as Psalm 23, the temple is called the house of God. That's a metaphor, because we all know what it's like to live in a house, right? Slavery and freedom being a picture or metaphor of sin and forgiveness. There's a lot of places you have that. One of my favorites from the chapter in Colossians, not the one we've read this morning, but talking about being brought into God's people as a transfer of citizenship. And there's a number of us who are here today who know what it's like to have been at one point in our life affiliated with a certain country and then through a legal process get affiliated by transfer of citizenship to a new one. So anyway, these are just some examples of some of the metaphors among many, many others that are in the Bible. The fact that so many are out there must mean that somehow relating to God must be important. Otherwise, we wouldn't, if you will, spend so much time making sure that we can get a picture of the opportunities that are before us. You use metaphors where you really want to capture something worthwhile. So it's not surprising that something that has been familiar to probably, I'm assuming, every society in the history of the world, namely adoption, should be used as one of these metaphors of how we can relate to God. It's a familiar fact of life. Everyone here knows the idea of adoption. There are people here I know today who were themselves adopted. There are other people here today who maybe adopted someone into their family. It's a familiar thing, transferring parental duties and rights from the birth parents to someone else who's not the biological parent is something that just, it seems, every culture, ancient and modern, was familiar with. It was, of course, on the one hand, to help promote the welfare of children, because little kids, especially babies, are vulnerable if someone's not going to do this. They're at risk. Common sense tells us that. But I want to point out another side that goes along nicely with the first. The first is true. I don't want to lose that. I'm going to be around that. But there's another side to it. Namely, think about the benefits to the parents, the people who do the adopting parents, the people who do the adopting. Ask people who either have adopted or have thought about it. They'll give you various reasons. But one of them that you'll hear is we want it to feel complete. You know, we wanted to have kids, we weren't having kids, we decided this was sort of part of completing our picture. So to some degree, adoption not only is a benefit for the child, but is for a certain benefit for the adopting parents, okay? And unlike guardianship, which usually has a period of time, adoption, at least ideally, is for life. You know, once it's done, you're part of that family forever. I hope it's a good connection, all right? By the way, in biblical times, just take a couple names that on a big scale, we're familiar with this. Whereas Jewish families tended to adopt their own. If someone died, family members tended to adopt within. But for Roman families, the people who did a lot of adopting were the aristocracy. And it's interesting, I'm sure completeness might have been part of the picture, but Roman aristocracy at the time of the Bible, at the time of the New Testament, would often adopt to assure leadership that would pass through the male line. And royal leadership in particular, as well as the property that was in the family, you tended to pass it through the male line. I'm not saying it's good or bad, I'm just saying statement of fact that there it is. So here's two names from the first century that you'll know. You may know the name Trajan. He was late in the first century, beginning of the second century. But there's another better known name. One of the most infamous emperors of Rome was adopted, and that was Nero. Okay? Nero had no biological right to be the next emperor, but it was by adoption. And today, you know, we say, boy, when you're adopted, everything changes. Absolutely. By the way, I like that line in 2 Corinthians 5:17, in Christ, all things are new. How true when you're adopted into a new family. I was thinking of two rather, I don't know if you knew these people were adopted, but they're rather well-known characters. Both have passed away. But in 1932, a single teen mom, whose name I think has been lost to history, decided to give her North American baby up for adoption. His taken name was David, okay? And he went on to, his name's Dave Thomas. If you've ever eaten at a Wendy's fast food restaurant, you're eating at the brainchild of a guy who was adopted. And I don't know how the adoption exactly figured in with his desires to build a business, but somehow they figure in there. By the way, in 1955, there were two grad students at the University of Wisconsin who found themselves with a baby on the way, decided they weren't quite ready to handle it. They adopted the baby out. Baby's taken name was Stephen. Okay, you know which one I'm going with. Stephen Jobs, okay, was adopted in the Jobs family, and he had his job cut out for him. Hey, can you do better? Can you do better? And you know the rest of the story. If you're carrying an Apple product today, as many of you are, you're carrying a product that was part of a brainchild of a man whose life changed because of adoption. Anyway, with adoption, new things. Think about it. New parents, most obviously. Also means a whole new set of relationships with, potentially, with brothers and sisters, not to mention extended family. And, you know, we're changed by our relationships. Whatever they are, they shape us. We shape others, they shape us. So you get adopted into a new family, the personality that you're acquiring, and not just the circumstances out there around you, but the very personality that shapes you is in some way, shape, or form going to change, all right? You're going to get a new location, new situation in life. By the way, I always get humored by this. You may be taking on a new language as well. As I was reminded back early on in the early years of our marriage, we weren't sure we were able to have biological kids. And so we thought, hey, you know, we'll just adopt some kids. So we made arrangements. We were in the process of adopting a little boy from Korea. We were well in the process. We're not too many months away from getting this child. We'd even have chosen a name. You'll love the name. We don't have him. We were going to name him Benjamin, because Benjamin means son of the right hand, and we had filled out so much paperwork, we're right-handed, we figured he literally would be son of the right hand. And we had a neighbor who was very concerned that we were going to adopt a Korean baby, and she, dear woman that she was, she comes to us, she said, but how's this going to work? You speak English forever, he's going to speak Korean, you won't be able to talk with each other. We explained there are other options. Anyway, turns out we had bios, so we stuck with the bio plan, but that's okay. And a whole new culture and worldview. This is reflected. Let me reread a couple phrases out of Galatians 4, which is where we're sort of home base this morning. Galatians 4, verse 4. When the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son. There's a metaphor of God's relationship with, you know, the Father's relationship with Jesus. Both of those are metaphors, because you know they're not meant to be literally true, okay? Born of a woman, there's the literal part, we know that that happened, born under or subject to the law. In other words, he comes very human. Now, one of the reasons, one of many, this is so important is this, and one of the early church fathers caught it nicely. He said, now ponder with it, it's a short quotation, that which he assumed, he also redeemed. That which he assumed, referring to Jesus, that which he assumed, in other words, whatever nature he took up would then allow him to go through a process of buying it on behalf of others. So by becoming human, in God's economy, he then became the one with the right to buy back humans. That which he assumed, he redeemed. Now coming on to verse 5. So in order that he might redeem those who were under the law, in other words, under the curse and the burden and the responsibilities. By the way, law is not all bad. You want to live in a law-abiding society because the alternative is deadly chaos. But being born under the law means subject to its statements, especially when they show that you are bad, okay? And so that we might receive adoption as sons. So here's God's son, use of metaphor, now allowing us to have some kind of a relationship. How do you capture what that's like? How do you capture a relationship with an unseen God for you and me as we live in day-to-day life here? How do you express that? Well, I can imagine many ways that the Bible expresses, but the one we're looking on is, it's a little bit like the relationship you have if you had adopted a child, or if you had been adopted, in all the ways we either know or we've talked about here. That's a way to envision the possibilities that God has with you and you have with God. It does not say everybody will experience that. It says, if you're curious, this is the zone that you have the rest of your life to explore, to adopt us from out there, something else going on, and bring us in. And that brings us down into verse 6. And he says, and because you're sons, now this is only to those for whom it's true, because you're sons, God sent forth the Spirit of his Son
into our hearts, leading us to say Abba or Dad or Father. Father, that intimate relationship that parents can have. One of the funny ways I learned this, and I'm so grateful to have had, and of course still have now adult children, because there were certain aspects of the relationship that would become apparent to me that I hadn't thought about. One of them, which I hold fairly fondly, is at the end of the workday when I'd go home. Particular house we were living in at the time, I'm imagining, was just a block up from Pizza Joe's. There's a big step from the front stoop up into the house. And the kids would see me coming home through the window. And the kids are smart kids. They know Dad holds the goods, you know? Whatever it is that they want, you know? Want me to get, want me to fix, want me to procure, whatever. And so I would actually, I do this for fun, but I really did this. I would count between the time my first foot went up on the step to step in the house, between that and when my second foot landed on the upper step, how many requests would I get from four eager kids? By the way, the limit I hit was 8. That's a pretty impressive number. Kids firing away requests in the time it takes to step one step. Now, what does that tell you? Think about it, because that's to appreciate the metaphor. What does that tell you? It tells you in their perception, I hope it was a truthful one, there is something about this guy who cares so much about us, he will be in tune with our deepest and most intense yearnings for, you know, whatever. It may have just been for ice cream, but the point is that that was the priority at the time. And that's a taste, just a taste, of what it would be like to be God's offspring. There's the metaphor for us. So, a lot of potential, a lot of possible things to have. I'd like to suggest a couple of consequences and have you maybe consider yourself in the larger picture here. Metaphors like adoption are cultural commerce. They're things that are familiar to us in self-evident ways that we've leaned on this morning. A man who made an interesting exploration of this is a retired missionary named Don Richardson, who, by the way, spoke on campus a handful of years ago, too. I was acquainted with his writings before, but it was nice to hear him. Don Richardson, in the 1960s, took a very brave, bold move, taking his wife and their, at that time, young child, to literally a head-hunting society in Papua New Guinea. Okay? Great risk for the family. I don't know how it worked out, but that's what they did. And out of his experience, he wrote a book that may be familiar to some of you. It's called Peace Child. And Richardson, in that book, raised an interesting question. He said that one of the cultural values of this weird society that he had reached is people prized the ability to be able to cheat and lie even to the people who trusted them the most. Now, why he'd ever developed that as a valued cultural thing, I have no idea. I'm just telling you what he tells about the story. But then the question is, but what happens when you really do want peace? You know, your village wants to be at peace with the next village, knowing that everybody values you can fake peace, but simply for the purpose of turning around and killing somebody. So he said, what did they do? They had to find a way for facilitating sanity. And the interesting thing he said is the answer became adoption. And what would happen is each village would come up with what they called a peace child. And they would take the child was born into their own, you know, one of the families in their own village, and they would deliver that child to the other village. And the same would go the other way. And it was the responsibility of the receiving village to keep, to hold on to protect, to embrace, to love, to provide for, and to raise that child as if it were their own. Adoption facilitated peace. And you can sort of see where Richardson's going with this for us. He says that cultural practice became in and of itself. Now, he used a fancier term than metaphor. He called it cultural compass or redemptive analogy. He said that became a wonderful way to point out exactly to the fact that God in heaven did that voluntarily, giving his child to us and thereby establishing peace. So I have a single question. I'll tease it out of it, but I have a single question to ask you in light of what we've explored today. Forgive me, but the question is, who's your daddy? I mean, really, who's your daddy? What I mean by that is, we've said that when you're adopted into a new family, the new family sets its experiences and standards as yours, okay? So I'm really asking two questions in one. I'm not putting on the spot. I'm asking for self-reflection. If you're someone who can say, I know I've been taken into God's family, that's the first part of it, okay? But I'd specifically like to address those of you who would say, I know I'm in God's family. Who really sets your standards? Because it is possible to be brought into one family and then actually be adopting the sometimes corrupt standards that broke down the first family from which you were taken. I've seen people who have been literally adopted in life. They grow up, they explore where their family came from. Nothing wrong with doing that, by the way. We have a curiosity. And then they've decided all the crud that they left behind with the adoption, they decided they're going to re-embrace it. That's what I mean when I say, consider, who's your daddy? Who is it that really keeps your imagination, your heart, and is guiding you with motivations? Here's another angle on the same question. The author is Tim Keller, very widely read Christian writer. Tim Keller writes a book on counterfeit gods. And he introduced me to an idea. At first when I read it, I thought, I don't know if I like this or not. I decided I did, but I had to work with it for a while. He talks about the difference between what he calls surface idols and deep idols. And he says sometimes people have surface idols where there's something wrong in their life, and they actually are able to walk past it and stop, you know, their involvement in whatever that wrongness is. However, he said, that doesn't necessarily mean that they've dealt with the roots of that. He uses an example, a friend of his who for years and years, short version, misused women in many, many ways. And he said his friend then repented from all the things he had done, but in his new relationships, he would dominate conversations. He would belittle people. He would put people down. He would control people verbally instead of sexually. And Keller's suggestion is, yeah, he gave up one surface idol, but his deep idol, his deep value system, gave away that something had yet to change. And that's what I'm thinking about when I ask, who's your daddy? If you look into the inner recesses of your soul in a way perhaps only you and God can really understand, who's there speaking? Whose voice do you hear speaking to you, leading you through the relationships of your day and the choices you make and the priorities that you have and the way you speak and the way you represent yourself and the priorities that you have? There's guaranteed to be a voice speaking to you of some kind. And the question is it your divine Father whose voice you hear there? This summer I've had the pleasure, just a brief note, it's very brief, on the other passage we read from Colossians 3. This summer I've had just an awful lot of fun officiating at quite a number of weddings, and at a couple of them I've read this passage that we read this morning. The gist of it being, if you're chosen by God, then put on a heart of compassion and kindness and humility and gentleness and all these kinds of things. All right? This only works. So I say to married couples, you know, make this the way you deal with each other for the rest of your life. But the command only makes sense if you're speaking to someone who has the ability, because they have a new parent, right, a new divine parent, to be able to really, really do those kinds of things. You, for example, you don't go up to a street urchin and say to the street urchin, I'd like you to behave like you're the king's son. It doesn't work. You can only go to the king's children, adopted in this case, and say, hey, because you are a king's heir, that royal character has things to talk to you about and wants to train you and shape you and let you build all your relationships of life with this. So I'm going to leave you with that question. When it comes to that part of your life, your priorities and loves, who's your daddy? Because I think if you can answer that metaphor good, you'll understand yourself better. And if we understand ourselves better, we'll understand God better. If we understand God better, we'll understand ourselves better. There's a nice symbiotic relationship there. And I hope this is a good way to direct you with that. Father, thank you for pictures that help us grasp profound things, and in this case, little bit of what it's like to be yours. In Jesus we pray it. Amen.